3, 4. Me and my friends do sinister things, and that's because we're cynical beings. And we're living in a house, and we're chilling upstairs, and we're doing a podcast. Impaired.
So I don't play a whole lot of video games anymore. I haven't for like the last time I actually sat down, before about a week ago. Like the last time I sat down and played video games for fun and actually like had a good time, and it was like natural, and I didn't feel this like weird guilt about not doing other things. I was like probably a senior in high school. Yeah. I'm just kind of weird about that, but I remember like when I was a senior playing a lot of like Fallout 4 when that was out, or it was kind of old at the time, but I was late on the train like always. But recently this long awaited mod slash basically like game out on for Fallout New Vegas came out.
I heard about that.
Yeah. It's been in development for like 7 years.
Oh wow.
And that game's only been out for like 8 or 9.
Right.
So it's been like these guys have been working on this big mod, like it's basically another base game add on. It's like 12 gigabytes, and I think the entire game with all the DLC is like 18 or something. So it's like a huge add on. They add like drivable cars, which is crazy, and the mechanics of the drivable cars are really sweet. But it's called The Frontier, and so it's a continuation of the story, and it's based in Portland. But the story is like there was like, you know, when the bombs went off in the Fallout universe, it was like through this big ash cloud over the sun, and Portland is like this snowy wasteland.
Right.
So like the whole
nuclear,
it's like
nuclear winter.
Yeah, patrolling the Mojave almost makes you wish for a nuclear winter. And they kind of took that idea and ran. And I've been playing the hell out of it. It's super awesome. And it's also, like, all the voice acting is, like, the people that worked on it. And it's all really, really good. And what it kind of made me think of on... because I played it for, like a day straight, like, nonstop. And it was, like, so fun. And it was, like, a good break, kind of.
Yeah, Cody's used to playing games for a full day straight. Even longer?
Well, not straight.
Yeah, okay.
We know you're not.
Multiple days in
Ouch.
A row, yeah.
That was not nice.
So
we love you, Cody.
You're playing for a full day straight.
I was playing a lot of this game, and it made me think of there's like a, you know, a lot of people play video games like all the time. Like that's their pastime, which
mm-hmm.
is cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a good industry, and a lot of the games that we play here in the United States are like develop the United States, so it kind of all stays, you know, it's all good, it's a good industry, when you play that much and you're like that involved in a world that isn't like, you know, you're like you're escaping into this like video game world,
right?
And it's really fun, but like a lot of people do it, and it's never like, you know, up until like 20-30 years ago you couldn't do that. You'd have to like figure out something to do that's not on a screen and virtual.
Yeah.
So what that made me think of is like the idea of escapism, and how pretty much everyone does it in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think most people find some way to unplug from their real life and then plug into something outside of that, you know.
Right. I know for like when I was growing up, I played like a ton of video games. I think everyone did. You know, everyone in this kind of generation played like a lot of video games growing up.
Right.
And like even though it's just crazy how much the percentage of my younger life that I spent like in front of a screen, like doing stuff on a computer or on like a console. It's just kind of crazy because like earlier generations couldn't do that. And they turned out differently than we did as we became adults, and we turned out differently. Even though like a lot of our time was not spent engaged in our own world, in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think people in the past, though, they had books. And people would get really into books. I know when I was younger, in, like, you know, 7th or 8th grade, I got really into a very specific book. And that was, like, my biggest escape was that book. So I tell people now, I'm the biggest nerd on this series that you have probably ever met, but that's just because I like put myself in that world. And
which book series is that?
Harry Potter.
Oh, Harry Potter.
I almost
that's true.
Almost
you're
guessed that.
You're up there. I mean, there's people that are a little bit more psychotic about it than you are.
Yeah.
But as far as trivia goes, yeah, you can hold your own for sure.
I only read the series once.
Which is kind of impressive considering your depth of knowledge.
Yeah.
You're in the 1%.
Yeah.
In that particular criteria.
I wouldn't be surprised if I actually were.
Oh, easy.
And so that what you're talking about, Ryan, about how different generations, it reminds me of this. I guess it's kind of a meme or macro or whatever, of people at a train station, and they're all like staring down at their phones. But then compared to it is a picture from like the 30s or something, and they're all at the train station looking at the newspaper. So I think it's a new phenomenon that we have all of the information right at our fingertips, and that's like a whole nother subject that we could get into, where in a lot of ways we have too much information, and our information is kind of decentralized. Again, that's a different topic. Through every generation, they found some way to keep themselves entertained and distracted and whatnot. So I think the way that we choose our distractions, though, certainly do shape us to some degree, yeah?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's healthy distractions, constructive distractions, and there's negative ones.
I feel like social media and phones in general, even though all of us are guilty, because it's just such a fundamental like cornerstone of how life is nowadays, is everyone has a phone, or almost everyone has a phone. But I think that social media, like at its core, is very antisocial. It's very easy. And like you said, if we didn't have phones, we would have something else. For a form of like, you know, like something you can carry with you that's like kind of an escape, where you can forget about your surroundings for a minute and not like stare off into space. But a big issue with like phones and social media is it's an excuse not to be physically social sometimes, or it can be.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Or like if you go to a party and you see like there are people that are just like on their phones, it's like their experience is revolving around sharing their actual physical experience of being at that party, and like I can't get with that. And have you guys ever seen I see them on Instagram all the time, which is, that's funny. That's very hypocritical in a way. But,
right.
the old footage of like high school graduating class in like 1999 or like 2004. And, it's like all these people with like this, like, you know, they just have like funny hair, 'cause it was a different time. Right. And, they're like
weird clothes.
Yep. And they're all like sitting at a table, like talking and like running around and being crazy and being like rambunctious, in a way that kind of we didn't get to experience.
Yeah.
Just because of our conditions and the time that we grew up. And it's like, it seems like we'd be a lot happier if we didn't. I mean, that's a very like blanketing outsider looking in statement. Because it, you know, there's a lot of other conditions. But it's like, man, if we didn't have Mark would always call them leashes.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you're so attached to it, and you don't even, it just becomes natural to be attached to it, and you don't even notice. But it's almost like we'd be happier and more social people if it wasn't as prominent, like phones and media.
Yeah.
Because it would force you to be social in ways you wouldn't normally be.
Right. I think that there can be a healthy amount, and I think a lot of people go beyond that healthy amount.
Right. And that's not always necessarily the individual's fault per se, because the apps that we're using are created in a way to be addictive and to force you, they can't force you, but for all intents and purposes, force you into using them for longer and longer and longer, and keeping you engaged. So that's kind of, it's pretty insidious, you know? And so my take on this, and I'll probably continue to say this over and over and over again, is that, like, it's created because of the way the internet developed, which is based on advertising and a freemium experience, basically.
Right.
So you're paying for these apps with your time and attention, and so that's becoming the new currency in a lot of ways.
Right, and people are always, well, freemium is a great way to put it. But people are always like, this is all free. Like, how do people make money from like revenue? And it's like, you know, your internet data costs money, so that's part of it too. But attention is a big thing. It's so hard to hold. It's everything is so like attention deficit, it seems nowadays. Not to sound like I have a lot of foresight otherwise, because this is like the generation that I grew up in. But attention is definitely, because there's so much media out there, you can never consume it all. There's so many.
Yeah.
I don't know if millions of hours. It's probably not millions, but like hundreds and thousands of hours of like YouTube video or
consumable hour.
Oh yeah. I don't know the actual numbers. I don't want to sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, but I don't. But it's the thing is that it's so hard to you have all this information you can look through, so making it actually attention grabbing and engaging is like the really hard part. And it's like that is it seems like I agree with you. That seems like that is like the new currency is media that is not only like actually decent media, but it's like attention grabbing and engaging. To where they're not just want to click off of it when they get bored.
Right. And that's an interesting phenomenon as well, that YouTube allows you to upload essentially like unlimited video, right? You know, you've got all those like crazy 10-hour playlists that are and those videos that aren't every video that's not getting tons of clicks is losing YouTube money because they have to take up space on their servers and whatnot.
Right.
And so it's been interesting to see how YouTube has started shifting away from smaller creators. Whereas, you know, smaller creators are kind of what helped build YouTube. Those like viral sensations are what drew people to YouTube where,
Fred. Nigahiga.
Oh yeah. But those viral sensations, one-hit wonders in a way.
Yeah.
It's crazy how those guys were like on top of the world at one point, and now there are probably a lot of younger people that have never heard that name.
Right, and I think they're still doing well for themselves. Like I know Fred. I think his real name was Lucas.
Yep, Lucas Crit. It's a weird last name.
Yeah.
His name's Lucas.
He got a spot on German or something. Like Nickelodeon or Disney or something like that.
Oh, but yeah. He made
Fred the movie.
Yeah. And he was on an episode of iCarly.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking like 10 years ago, though.
Right.
Like, I wonder how they're doing like now and if they're still making like media that's making them an income.
I know Ryan Higa, he's still on YouTube and he's been doing some stuff with other YouTubers, like collabs. So he's still pulling in that revenue.
And he's had a lot of success still on YouTube. Like, he still pulls in millions of views on his newest videos.
Yeah.
But the point I was trying to get at is I think it's interesting how YouTube is moving away from those smaller content creators. And they're trying to focus more on longer, more substantive and, like, produced videos, stuff that's going to draw in more viewers, and they're incentivizing that in their structure, you know.
Right, it's all about the numbers, you know. If it's more profitable to make like a longer, more you know, it's like a longer video with more runtime, that's more viewer time. So I mean, it makes sense from like an economic standpoint. You know, if they can have a channel or a creator that makes a new video like every week or twice a week, and it's a 10-minute video, and a few million people are gonna watch it, that's gonna outstand all the small creators that have like, you know, videos that don't, you know, maybe they have like one or two videos that has over a million views, but most of them don't. From like a number standpoint, of course, YouTube is going to pursue more income.
Right, it makes sense.
More profitable.
Because I don't know, I know this has been the case, and I don't know if this is still the case, but for a long time, YouTube wasn't actually profitable. They've just been kind of like banking on it becoming profitable eventually. But I think for quite a while, they weren't actually making any money and, in fact, were losing money on YouTube. And so I'm curious how long it's going to take before YouTube pushes smaller creators out even further, you know?
Them not being... I didn't know that they weren't profitable for a long time. I figured they'd be making something from the start. But that's... I mean, that's good proof that... if something isn't working out right away, then not to quit doing it, because sometimes it's like right around the corner when you can actually start being successful in what you do.
I think Amazon had that problem as well. They weren't making money for a long time, and then they blew up.
Right, and some of it is, you know, you're depending on angel investors to keep you going. I think Tesla's the same way.
Yeah.
Initially not profitable. And now, like, their stock has skyrocketed. And I still don't know for sure whether they're profitable. Like, there's a lot of people betting against Tesla.
Right. Even Elon Musk thinks that Tesla stock is way overpriced. Or at least he was quoted saying that recently. I understand why people are buying it, but it's not worth that much.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, he owns the company. But...
He's also, as of recently, the richest man on Earth. I don't know if you guys heard about that.
Yeah. I heard that he was the second richest man.
No, he passed Bezos recently.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Yeah, he's the richest man on Earth with a recorded net worth.
Right. Right. You've got Mohammed bin Salman, right? The like crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Right. I mean, that guy, technically those assets are the country's, but since he's the monarch of the country, he pretty much owns it. So,
yeah.
You know.
In a roundabout way.
Right. So, you know.
What do you guys think of Jeff Bezos? A lot of, I know that a lot of people resent him in a certain way. What do you guys think about Jeff Bezos? And, because he's different. He's not quite like Elon Musk, because Bezos built his business off of like sales and profiting, whereas Elon Musk, it's been like a bunch of really well calculated passion projects. But Bezos is, from the start, it was going to be a big wealthy company, or at least a very customer centric company was always his goal. What do you guys think of him?
I think he kind of, you know, hit a home run on his idea. Like, I think a lot of people don't like him because he has a lot of money.
Right.
I don't resent him for that.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong here, but Amazon wasn't always a shipping company, right? It started off as books, right?
Yep.
Which is kind of wild how they... I don't know how they made that transition. I still am not really sure, but it worked.
They probably, you know, don't quote me on this, but they probably started selling, like, you know, trinkets and stuff. Like, you go into a Barnes & Noble and they have, you know, other novelty items there. And they saw how well they sold. So, they, you know, add something else on there too. Go from there.
Sure, yeah.
It definitely, from what I know about Amazon, it started as he lived in New York or somewhere out east, and then they moved across the country to Seattle because he saw it to be a prime area, prime, no pun intended, for shipping, for whatever reason. It was just a better area for shipping. I think that was a story.
Huh.
But they started selling books, and I remember I watch a lot of videos about wealthy guys and what they do, and Jeff Bezos is really funny in a way, because he's very, he focuses like sometimes on the wrong things, and he like admits to it. He was telling this anecdote of they were so slammed with sales when they were starting, and they were like in a small, like garage sized warehouse, in Seattle. and they were shipping all these books. They were packing boxes, and they were like on their knees on a concrete floor packing these boxes with books.
Yeah.
And you had a group of like less than 50 people working with them. And they were packing all these boxes, and Jeff is like, oh my gosh, my knees are killing me. Like we're crouched down on this concrete packing books. Like my knees are killing me. Like, are yours? And the guy's like, oh yeah. He's like, wait, we need knee pads. And the guy's like, or we can get shipping tables. And he's like, oh yeah, that makes sense too.
Right.
So their business seems to be, in his words, very like so customer centric. And that's why I got so big, is because it's benefited so many people's lives. And he's also profited a lot from it. But most of the equity is in the company, I think. I don't think he actually carries a lot of the company's wealth. He just owns the company.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Most of his wealth, and most billionaires' wealth, tied up in stocks and whatnot. Like, not a lot of people have...
liquid assets.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd have to be, you know, not very bright to carry all that money in liquid assets.
Right. Because the dollar.
Yeah.
The stock is going to, well, theoretically continue to creep up and up and up, but the dollar is not going to, the value of your dollar is just going to continue to go down, so it doesn't really make sense to carry that.
Inflation, I think, is going to get pretty wild here pretty soon, just because of how, because, like, the economy stems off of labor and goods, and, you know, like, an intrinsic value of things. So, especially with all of the, a big thing is, like, everyone is on unemployment, and that money has to come from somewhere. If things aren't getting done, and, like, goods and services aren't being provided, then that money is just paper. It doesn't have any value because things aren't being done to make it of value. It's kind of the best way I can put that without really having that much knowledge on economics. But I think this is, like, one of the best times to actually buy things and put your money into literal useful assets. Like, a lot of guys are like, oh, cryptocurrency. But that's just as volatile, if not more volatile. I just bumped my mic. I hope that wasn't really loud.
You're good.
Okay. But cryptocurrency is really volatile. But, like, just having, like, physical stuff, because we don't know how things are going to go here soon. And with all the spending on, like, the virus stuff, the dollar is getting less and less valuable, like, quick. So there are a lot of investor guys that are speaking more about, like, buying precious metals and buying, like, physical useful assets,
mm-hmm.
and spreading your wealth out that way rather than investing quite as much in the stock market, because that's all based off the dollar.
Yeah, I've heard more and more people saying buy silver.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real.
It will always be worth something.
Yeah.
I think precious metals always tend to go up in times of crisis.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you can know when a crisis is going to happen, it's always good to buy precious metals before then. So that way, when they go up, you can sell at the height of the crisis.
But right. I love when foresight is 2020.
Right. Because
it always is.
Yeah.
It's like, man, I wish when it was 2012 and we were all like 12 years old or 13 years old, we would have bought a bunch of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That would have been really cool. But foresight's 2020. We didn't do that because we were, like, busy being kids. Or, yeah, hindsight, excuse
me. Also, like, what kind of assets did we have? Like, $10?
Yeah, the only...
What would $10 in Bitcoin...
Well...
20 years... Or, yeah.
10, yeah, but you also have to have, like, you know...
Have you guys ever heard of the first Bitcoin transaction?
No.
What it actually was? Some guy bought two pizzas at a pizza place for 10,000 Bitcoins.
Yeah.
And now one Bitcoin is, I think, as of the other day, is like $30,000.
Yeah,
that's crazy. Well, have you guys heard recently, it's been in the news, about a guy who, like, lost a hard drive that had a bunch of Bitcoin on it?
He forgot his password, and it's encrypted, and they only give you, like, a certain amount of tries. And he said he's come to terms with it.
Yeah, ouch.
Like, hundreds of millions of dollars in Bitcoin.
Yeah, so some people were recommending, like, hypnotherapy to try and get it to come back, stuff like that.
No resort is too, you know, what resort do you have to, I mean, it'll be worth it in the end if it works.
I mean, yeah. To me, hypnotherapy is probably, you're probably just as good as going to like a witch doctor and having them try and pull it out of you. But yeah, you know, if that's what jogs your memory, then that's what jogs your memory.
Right. I might even like hire a couple of ex-KGB agents just to like torture me for a little bit, just try get
right
get that code out of me.
They could do it to me for free.
Yeah.
What do you guys know about the because speaking of hypnotherapy, what do you guys know about like the subconscious mind?
I don't know a whole lot. Do you have any insight?
Yeah, the subconscious mind is crazy, because like you have your conscious mind, which is like conscious mind. It's really hard to put into words in a way, but your subconscious mind has stored like every memory you've ever had, like to when you started actually retaining memories. Like your subconscious stores everything, and that's why sometimes you have like this weird random memory from like years ago. At least I do. I'll have this random memory that like I forgot that even happened. Like this one particular setting at this one place when I was like 7 years old, and I'll like remember it. And that's because it's a subconscious thing. And there's also it's not a theory, it's a practice of like autosuggestion. So like the more you tell yourself something and the more you really believe that it's true, the more your subconscious mind will actually make your personality kind of absorb it.
Interesting. Yeah.
You can say like, oh, I'm gonna be super successful one day. I'm gonna like do all this stuff. I'm just gonna make this happen. Even if it seems like really unfeasible. And if you just keep telling yourself it, your mind will actually it'll embed it in a way where it'll make steps for you. It's kind of
right,
weird.
Right.
The subconscious mind is like a very, it's like 90% of your brain, and your conscious mind is only about, I think, 10%. There's some kind of ratio some psychologist came up with.
Yeah, it's kind of like fake it till you make it, but it actually works.
Right.
It's the iceberg. Have you ever
seen? No, what is that?
Like the concept of an iceberg is, you know, you've got 10% of the iceberg above the water and 90% of the iceberg is below the water. And so I think I've seen that in relation to the conscious and subconscious mind. Was it Freud that kind of like championed
Sigmund
that?
Sigmund Freud, I think, was one, I don't know.
One of the psychologists.
This book that I read recently told that guy's name a lot, talking about autosuggestion, so you're probably right.
Yeah.
It probably was him.
I mean, Freud had a lot of ideas, and not all of them have kind of...
He's had some pretty garbo ideas.
Like what?
He's just a weird guy.
Oh. He had
we can't air that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He just had some weird ideas about like sexuality and like basically just strange, like penis envy for one. Basically that like women, everyone wants to have a penis, including women.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The Oedipus complex, that whole.
Right.
Yeah. Just some very strange psychological concepts that really haven't stood the test of time. But for a long time, he was considered like the premier psychologist. And so the stuff kind of. He's shaped a lot of the field of psychology, even though they've decided that a lot of his stuff is bunk. He's still a renowned psychologist.
Right, and that's kind of the concept of science is, you know, you come up with something until it's disproven.
Right. You can always theorize.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. Science is, it's a process, you know?
Yeah.
And so you just test one hypothesis. And then you keep testing hypotheses until you learn about the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything is up for debate, you know. It's, because, like, the field of science isn't, it's always open. It can be added or expanded upon by anyone. Unless you come up with, like, a law. And then that's a law. You can't disagree with it. So.
Yeah. And I have a kind of a pet peeve about people saying like you can't argue with the science, but that's not really true because that's what science is for in a lot of ways. Like
yeah.
Scientists argue with the science,
right.
You know, like scientists love to argue and every scientist thinks they're right, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, I think scientists have some of the biggest egos out of anyone. And so that certainly plays a role in science as well. Like, there's kind of a joke that in order for science to move forward, you just have to sit around and wait for the old tenured professors to pass away. And, then science can move forward. But, you know, those old ideas that are being held, they take a while to be disproven.
I like what you say about the ego thing and how, because to try to put truth to something that you can't explain or that you can't easily explain without, you know, massive funds like in testing and you know, like all the measures to take to actually figure something out, to try to put a law to that or to put that into words when everyone else is going to disagree with you takes some ego. You have to have some kind of confidence in what you've studied and what you know.
Right, without a doubt. Like,
more than the average person.
Yeah, and okay, I know Edison gets a lot of crap, but if Edison didn't have the ego that he did, then I don't think a lot of the inventions that he at least contributed to creating wouldn't be around.
We have a lot of great things in the world because of people with egos. Like Henry Ford, like horrible guy to work for, but he was very, very, he's very, very driven for things to be the way that he wanted it. And, like if it didn't work, he said, try harder. If you're familiar with like when they invented the V8 engine, all of his engineers were like, we can't do this. This isn't physically possible to put all of these cylinders in one block. And he's like, okay, we'll just keep trying. And then like 6 months later, they're like, this is not possible. We cannot do this. And he's like, okay, well, I'm paying you. Keep trying. And then 6 months later, they got it. And it shaped the world. It's having the fortitude to keep like driving forward, against like, all odds and all, adversity.
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways that describes America.
Yeah, true.
Like that's kind of the American spirit, is you just keep forging forward, and that gets America in a lot of trouble at times.
True.
When it turns out that we're very wrong, but in a lot of ways that forging spirit, I think, is it's a really good quality to have for sure.
Yeah.
Right. It's a lot of times better than it's better than not having it, or it's better than your other options.
Right. I think it's better than having like a nihilistic view where you're just like, oh, well, it doesn't matter anyway, and I can't do it, and whatever, I'll just give up.
Right. And that forging forward a lot of times is, it's obviously in pursuit of like personal wealth. But at the same time, usually with that and with all good business, everyone benefits. And if everyone isn't benefiting, then you're not doing good business. Like Andrew Carnegie was like a big steel. He was like a big guy in the steel industry back in like the early 1900s, late 1800s.
Steel chainsaws.
No, steel.
Steel.
Not like steel chainsaws.
Actual steel.
Like actual steel, like building railroads.
Oh, okay. I see.
Andrew Carnegie. No, steel chainsaws were like not relevant in comparison to that. But even though he was like totally a tycoon and was like super, super in it for the money, and wouldn't pay his employees anything, and in many ways was a really kind of not a great businessman, but he just kind of monopolized it in a way. It was choicefully monopolized. I mean, he bought other companies because it was kind of weird. It was kind of a weird deal. But think about what we have nowadays due to railroads and due to like, I think it was like the American Steel Corporation or company or something. Think about how far that got us, because this one guy, even though he was in it for himself, it still benefited everyone. And that's why he went down in history very, very famous. That was because everyone benefited off of it.
Yeah.
This kind of goes back to the idea of Amazon. You know, like a lot of people hate Amazon because it's driving big box stores out of existence, and it's in a lot of ways kind of reshaping the economy towards shipping and everybody convenience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
like without Amazon, do you think we would have DoorDash?
No.
The same people that This is my kind of somewhat humble, like not so nice opinion, but the same people that hate Jeff Bezos because he has a ton of money spend $100 on Amazon a week because it's convenient and because that they're consumers and they're so it's a lot of hypocrisy. But in a lot of ways, like with DoorDash, the advancements of that certain company has done good for everyone, and you can't argue it really. Like Amazon has benefited. I mean, like you can get stuff at a good price really fast. It's hard to say no to it, even in the lieu of like wanting small businesses to like maintain and stay around. It's like that Dan Kennedy's album, "Give Me Convenience or Give Me Death."
Yeah,
it's the same idea. Humans are like that, you know. Whatever's convenient, even if it's not the most just thing, it's convenient, and you don't have to worry about it for too long. And it's just quick and easy to order something off of Amazon.
That's true, and in some situations, it can actually make more economic sense to get an Amazon package rather than to go to wherever it is and to pick it up.
Totally,
especially out here.
Totally,
You know, out here on the Olympic Peninsula, there's a lot of stores that aren't out here, and so to get niche equipment, you would have to drive over to Seattle or wherever, Tacoma, you know.
Yeah, at least for the closest outlet to where you can actually buy like specialty things.
Right, and so you know, unless you're going over there to get a bunch of stuff, it doesn't really make sense, and so it's better. It makes more economic sense. You're saving money by having Amazon ship it to you or whatever company.
And shipping's always been a thing, like since the industry has started or since like the Industrial Revolution has started. Shipping's always been a thing, but it's just so much more streamlined in fewer companies nowadays, and it can kind of only go one direction. I mean, Amazon is not going to probably get any smaller here anytime soon.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird. Everything kind of centralizes and consolidates into like one big thing, and it's kind of sketchy.
Yeah,
but that's a direction that everyone's pushing it. It's all by choice. Everyone could decide to quit buying stuff from Amazon, but no one's going to.
Yeah, the invisible hand of the market.
Yep.
At work.
Yep.
There is one thing limiting Amazon.
Real estate.
No, okay, so this is kind of, I don't know if this is necessarily conspiracy theory.
Oh,
but
we should probably just dive right into that.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that idea.
Okay, so, and my information might be outdated, but this was just a comment I heard that kind of resonated, and I thought it was interesting, so I'll bring it up even though I'm probably out of my depth here. Okay, so Jeff Bezos moved to Washington, D.C.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Why do you think that is?
Recently.
I don't know, within the past couple of years.
Get closer to the politicians.
Yeah. That's the theory, right? So, like, why... Yeah, there's no other reason for him to move to Washington, D.C. other than to schmooze and, like, be next to the people that are potentially limiting his growth.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's especially true because I think like Amazon, Google, and Apple were all hit with monopoly charges by the federal government, right? I think that's correct.
Huh.
So it makes sense to have lobbyists and even your CEO out in Washington, D.C., close to the action, so you can, you know, get your word in before people start putting limits on you.
Right. I think one thing, though, is giant corporations, for them, a fine is just part of the business. Like the...
Right, it's built in. It's built into their... Like, they have money that they set aside for that.
Right. They're not hurting.
Yeah. Yeah. They're okay with it. Well, like, a good example how monopolies can be extremely... Can be harmful and beat up other companies Even when you lose the lawsuit, is like Microsoft.
Right.
Microsoft and IBM, I think it was. So, you know, Microsoft made all this money on bundling software. I'm pretty sure, again, probably out of my depth here, but bundling software with their operating system. And so, and they drove out a lot of the competition. And then it went to court, and the court said, yeah, you have a monopoly on it. But by that time, all the other companies were like totally, they were totally screwed over. Like they were,
there was no way to catch up.
Right. And so, you know, look at Microsoft now.
Yeah.
They played dirty and they kind of won.
Hmm.
And then, and whatever fines they got were worth it in the long run, because they were able to just drive everybody else out and topple them. And so, you know.
So there was technically no monopoly, but there was no competition. It was...
Right, at that point.
They stamped them out, pretty much.
Yeah, at that point. They just had given themselves such a head start that it didn't matter what the other companies were up to, because they were just leagues ahead.
Sounds like they played their cards right.
Well, yeah. I mean, when, unfortunately, the economy is kind of a game. And economists talk in terms of game theory, right? Like,
yeah.
that's a common thing. So, you know.
You know. Huh. Well, yeah, no, it's monopolizing is weird, and it's obviously hard to do nowadays, and it was, like, in the Industrial Revolution, it was really easy, if you have the upper hand, to just buy out all your competition, because then even buying out all the competition, everyone still wins, because like you're buying these people companies for like, you're basically, it's a blank check, and they're like, okay, I won't compete with you for this exuberant amount of money, and they would pay it, and then they would get all of their assets or all of their tools or their factories for their business. But there are, I think that there is an actual law written on monopolizing. It was like a really old law. It was like late 1800s or early 1900s. So there's been an actual law about it in place, but still it doesn't stop people from, you know, if you stomp out your competition, you stop out your competition. So how far,
right,
are we, how far are we in?
45.
Okay.
I think it's also, you say that was more of a thing back in the day, but I don't know, I'm sure it to some degree, but it's also definitely a thing now. Like every tech startup's dream is to get big enough for one of the bigger companies to buy them out, right? And then...
Then you're set.
Right. And then the CEO retires and they're like, woo.
I guess, I mean, yeah, not every small company wants to, like, I mean, I know that, like, with what I do, which is, we'll never make that much money, but with what I do, like, on my personal stuff, I don't want to be the biggest out there. No one's ever going to buy me out. But if that were the case, if you get bought out, you can move on to your next project.
Right.
And yeah. And you get an enormous check, and you're pretty much set for a long time. So, I mean, that's like a cash out. I can see how,
right,
people would want that. Not everyone has like the persistence and like, "Oh, I'm going to be the biggest. I'm going to do something no one else ever has."
Yeah, I've heard that there's people out there that's how they make their money, is they just build up a business big enough where a bigger company will buy them out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they sell out, and then they go on to the next thing, and they do it all again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can make an insane living that way.
Well, didn't Elon Musk kind of do that with PayPal?
He kind of did.
Right.
He started PayPal.
And he had a company even before PayPal, I think.
Yeah, I remember, yeah, because he sold his company. I remember seeing an old interview with him. He had sold his first company. I don't know what that company was. But and then he's like, all right, I'm thinking of this new online banking type thing.
Right.
It's gonna be like internet banking, and everyone's like, oh, that's not gonna work. And then he made PayPal.
Right.
And I don't remember what his first company was, but it seems like he's been doing that for up until recently, where he's kind of sticking to his stuff more.
Yeah.
Did he sell like the Boring Company, or is he still?
I think the Boring Company is still in operation.
His ownership.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. I mean, what? Who would be crazy enough to take that on?
I know. Yeah. What a crazy guy.
But yeah, PayPal is really interesting because, like you were saying, everybody was like, no, that won't work. And they had to go through.
Everyone says that.
Yeah.
You're always going to hear that. But
they had to go through hell to get it to work. Like they had to contact a bunch of banks and contact a bunch of lawyers and like get it to meet itself out. So it wasn't like, look, from our perspective now, it seems crazy that online banking would not be a thing, and that you couldn't pay for things online because now you pay for everything online.
Right.
But at one point, you just, like, couldn't.
Right. It just didn't make sense. It just wasn't done yet. And it's like, how would that even work? Because no one knew, except for the ones that had the foresight.
Right. And that contribution to the economy, I mean, it's hard to say that if you make that massive of a contribution to the economy and to people's ease of life, that you shouldn't be compensated in some regard, you know?
Right.
Like that.
That's how it works in our, we live in a capitalist system, and that's just kind of how she goes. Capitalism works for you if you work for it.
Ooh, wow.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, speaking of capitalism, how was your guys' day at work today?
This
morning.
Yeah, got a few hours of sleep last night, so.
Oh. I got like 9, it was pretty nice.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
But your occupation is actually meaningful.
Yeah, so for our viewers, our listeners out there, I'm an EMT for a private ambulance company. I work 24-hour shifts. And
not for me.
Yeah, sometimes they're great. Sometimes they aren't great.
24-hour shifts.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much sleep would you say you get on average on a 24-hour shift?
Probably around 5 total. It all depends. Some days you'll go and run 2 calls all day, and then some days you're on your feet or driving for the full 24 hours.
But those 5 hours are like in the form of naps.
Yeah.
They're not actually like right. Good sleep.
Right. It's like, you know, you'll lay down for 2 hours and then a call will drop, and then you got another 2 hours after that.
Right. That's pretty gnarly.
Would you say that, like, from before you started and after you started, how has that impacted your health? Do you think it's impacted your health at all? Or is it just kind of you work and then you get caught up and then you're kind of back to normal?
Yeah, it's definitely had a negative impact on my energy levels. But usually by the time, because I do get 4 days off, so our schedule is one day on, one day off, one day on, one day off, one day on, 4 days off. Usually by the end of my weekend, my 4 days off, I'm pretty much rejuvenated.
What do you enjoy most about working for a private ambulance company? Because it's obvious the things that aren't so great.
Yeah, so really I like the rush of it. I really dig the rush when a call drops and it is something that is, you know, a lot of people don't get to experience. And then the best part is when it's like a save, like a big save. Not too long ago, there was a, you know, kid in his mid-20s that OD'd and We got there fast enough and did everything that we needed to do and brought him back, took him to the hospital. He was fine when we dropped him off at the hospital, which is pretty good for an OD.
And right. Was that like a Narcan save or?
Yeah, so we had him intubated. Well, we had it's called a supraglottic airway. It goes like to your epiglottis. Oh, gotta do my homework a little bit here, but it goes down to your epiglottis and it blocks off. It blocks air from going into your stomach, so it pushes it straight into your lungs instead. So we pop that in, and when someone is unconscious, they don't have a gag reflex, so it's easy just to slide the...
You literally just shove it down their throat.
Yeah.
Sorry, maybe you're getting to this, but what does that do?
Yeah, so when someone is unconscious there and not breathing, it's to push oxygenated air into their lungs so that they continue to circulate oxygen throughout their body and most importantly to their brain.
Okay, so basically you're breathing for them. Is that kind of okay?
Yep. So we will put we'll attach something called a bag valve onto it, and it's like a hand powered pump that pumps air into your lungs via the supraglottic airway, or eye gel is the ones that we're currently using. And then we're able to attach that to an oxygen bottle to push oxygen straight into the lungs instead of just surrounding air. So yeah, we did the airway, and I believe the medic pushed Narcan through the bone, so you can drill into a shin bone and push medication through your bone.
Is there any benefit to doing it that way versus, because you can do it intranasally, you can like shoot it up into their nose, right?
Right.
So is there any benefit to doing it in the shin bone, or is it just you've got stuff in his face, so it's easier for you guys to go down to his shin?
A lot of times we will hope that it will prevent people from ODing again.
Oh, gotcha. So it's kind of incentive not to OD again.
Yeah. Just there are reasons, but that's beyond my scope of practice.
Probably gotcha. Probably hurts the morning after.
Yeah.
A needle in your shin bone. Right. It must be a really indescribable feeling to work with a very trained team of people to make efforts in possibly saving a life.
Yeah, it's
because it's not like you're out there. It's not like, oh, I'm out there saving lives, because it's like, I would imagine that like it's everyone's activity comes together to go towards one common goal of saving this one person.
Yeah, and you know, I've worked with people who were not it didn't really click in the team, and when you're with a crew that you really just click with, things just flow so smoothly and you do everything right. And that's how you save lives.
Is it what's the ratio of when you're out there on a big shift? What's your ratio of days where you're just doing, like, as you've described it to me before, calls that are like a waste of time? Versus ones that are actually right. I'm glad we showed up for this, you know?
Yeah, so a lot of people
maybe it's not best to characterize them as a waste of time, yeah. But
not as that they are, but like as, you know, this didn't need an ambulance call.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right. Or
they could be a waste of time. You don't know.
Or not a medic. Like EMTs could handle this. Like myself, I could go there and they didn't have to call 911 for this. They could have called us directly instead. So I would say that those situations are probably 90% to 10%. 90% are they didn't need to call 911, and 10% they did. But That's not to discourage anyone for if they feel like they need an ambulance to call 911.
Right. It's better to be safe than sorry.
Right.
Right.
And so, a lot of times, even if it is a fall, I have coworkers that have said they've gone to just a fall lift assist and walked in and done CPR.
Sure. So you get a call for one thing, and then it turns out that it's a little bit more serious than you initially anticipated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last night we went to a call for troubles breathing. You know, someone that's having difficulty breathing, which usually isn't like that big of a deal. And they're able to come back from it, you know, and not even need a transport to the hospital. But on our way there, dispatch said, hey, the reporting person stopped responding. So we ended up upgrading and going with lights and sirens to that call, which we don't go lights and sirens to every call. There's a very specific...
like a parameter type.
Right. In our protocols, it'll tell us what we can and can't.
Were you about to say something, Brady?
No, go ahead.
Has you doing this job, which from an outsider looking in, I could imagine that this job is, you see things that normal people will never see in their lives, and you see it on a very frequent basis. Just like people in such distress. And in such like needing times, and in, you know, you walk into like someone's residence, and it's like,
right, we make that our workplace,
right? Exactly. Has doing this for a period of time now, has this changed the way that you look at things? From what your point of view was before, probably in a few ways, but does it change the way you look at things from like? Has it changed your like your theistic standpoint, like your has it made you be any more or less like aware of a higher power, if you believe in that? If you get what I'm saying,
from a theistic standpoint, nothing has really changed. I've been, you know, fairly religious all my life, so not really from there. But as far as other things, like noticing things on a medical level, I was able to tell that someone had liver failure the other day because his skin was kind of yellow.
Oh yeah.
And he had already known about it, but I just said offhand, "You have something wrong with your liver."
Interesting.
He said,
"You're glowing."
Yeah. I said, "Yeah, actually I do. How did you know that?" So it's a good conversation starter.
Totally.
I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I think prying into people's, you know, medical private lives isn't always the most ideal thing, but no, you know.
So for our listeners, I'm also a reservist in the Marine Corps, and this was a fellow Marine, so it's...
Oh, gotcha.
It's
one of the brothers.
Yep, different dynamic.
Right. Has being in this field changed the way you think about things? I don't know if you believe in like the concept of fate. But does it ever seem like things work out in a certain way where it's like against all odds and it shouldn't have worked out that way, and it's just weird that it worked out that well? Do you ever run into anything like that? Or is it all pretty like you would expect, you know, you have your ups and your downs.
Yeah, I think it's the second one. You've got good times and bad. I can't think of anything off the top of my head where things worked out that way because they should have, or it was fate for it to happen like that. But yeah, it's sometimes it's a good day, sometimes it's not.
Man, fate's kind of a crazy topic.
Fate is a crazy topic.
It's, I think as humans, we tend to not want things. We don't want things to be predetermined, right?
We want to be able to explain things.
Yeah, Yeah. But we also, I think part of our ego is that we want to have control over ourselves and over our lives and over the, in some ways, over the people around us. And so, like, the idea that things are predetermined, that there is some sort of fate, is kind of scary.
It's kind of discomforting.
It'll push you right into an existential crisis.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, quickly. No, it's just, it's strange how it seems like sometimes things work out way too well. Or sometimes things work out so bad that it's like, okay, how could this get any worse? It seems like things stack up, and I think that the human mind just tries to put a pattern to it and tries to put like a rhyme or reason to like its input and its stimuli and what it perceives. But the idea of fate is really weird because it's universally recognized as like everyone has a concept of, oh, like things work out for a reason or things don't work out for a reason. Like across religions, I'm pretty sure that all people of different religions and different like standpoints have that same concept of fate. It's just strange how the human mind like has to put definitions and patterns to things like that that we can't explain because we want to be able to explain things.
Right. I think our brains, that's just the way our brains are wired, is to find patterns and to read into things sometimes even more than is there. And that's a double-edged sword for sure.
Yeah. No, it's a strange thing, especially, and a lot of times it's explainable. Like fate can be explained, or like when something works out in a certain way and it's like, oh, it's almost like it was meant to happen. Like an anecdote for that is, when I was in college, I didn't have health insurance for a lot of the time, even though I should have, cause I was a college student. And then, one day I'm like, you know, I'm like riding dirt bikes all the time. I probably should get health insurance. So I applied for it and I got it. And 4 days later, I broke my knee.
Oh, wow.
4 days later, it would have been like $30,000 for that entire experience. And I got insurance right before. And it also happened, like it happened on a particular day where like I was, you know, it was the next day was the last day at school that week. And so I was able to go like right home after I made an attempt to show up for school. And that exact same weekend, my uncle happened to be going back to Port Angeles. So I happened to get a ride back to Port Angeles. He was already going there. And I was like, even though I just like permanently damaged my body, it's weird how this all fell into place. And it's hard to explain because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But stuff like that happens. I don't know if I just recognize it all the time. But when stuff like that happens, it's like, how can we... it's all circumstance and it's all, what's that word? Coincidence. But it would be really cool to be able to explain that, but you can't.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's where, it seems like that would be fate.
Right. I do have a story like that. It's not as impressive as that one.
I do want to hear it though.
So I had a patient and I was putting his contact information. The hospital will print off a piece of paper for us to put into our reports with the patient's contact info in it. And I'm writing my report and my mother's phone number was on this person's contact information, which she doesn't have any idea who this person is. It was not this patient's phone number, but for some reason, out of the three crews that were working, that work at the
Olympic Ambulance.
Right. And out of the four crews that work on that shift, so three shifts and four crews per shift, and then me and my partner, I happened to be the one to write that report. It was just
right out of all the number of people that it could have been.
Right. So right away. So there's three shifts.
Yeah.
And four ambulances per shift.
Yeah.
And each ambulance has two people on it.
Yes.
So there were potentially 12 different crews. Basically, there's a 1 in 24 chance that you got to see this phone number.
Yeah.
So right away, that's kind of astounding. And then also the fact that it was your mom's phone number, right? That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's weird.
It's kind of spooky.
Very spooky. Someone's looking out for us.
Yeah.
Even though that's not my background, but sometimes it's kind of hard to like think about things in any other way.
Yeah.
The way that everything is, everything like from a biological standpoint is so perfect for humans, and like life is so easy compared to how it could be. It's kind of crazy. I don't think about that much, but when I do, I kind of quit thinking about it because you can't answer it.
Right.
Do you have any instances like that, Brady, where stuff worked out really, really weird?
It's more similar to Cody's. It's not necessarily working out really weird, but I was in a training, really low level version of what you guys are talking about. I was in a training at work, and this woman who was leading this training, there were only like three or four of us in the training. And the woman that was leading it, for some reason, she called me Cody, and I was like, wait, what?
Out of all the names.
Right. So, and she was like, I feel like your name should be Cody. And I was like, my name is Brady.
What?
My name is Brady. But it was super bizarre because she did not know that Cody, you were my brother.
Yeah.
It was just really weird. And she called me Cody like multiple times. Like she really had it in her head that my name was Cody. And I was like, this is so wild because that's definitely my brother's name and you have no way of knowing that.
That's spooky.
But
did you tell her?
Yeah, I told her, and she was, I don't know. She wasn't quite that quite as amazed at it as I was. Obviously, you know,
that's wild.
Being close to the situation.
She had a lot of names to choose from in the English language.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just one of those situations where it's like very bizarre. I don't know, you know? Weird.
Can't explain it. You can't explain it other than that's how it happened and it was just coincidence.
Yeah.
But that's just a theory.
A game theory.
Don't DMCA strikes.
Film theory.
Yeah.
That's
an
also
upstairs theory.
Is it actually copyrighted or is it just IP?
Whatever.
Yeah. I don't think you can get in trouble for saying. Yeah, we're good.
Matt Pat, I watch your YouTube channels. Please don't strike us.
3, 4. Me and my friends do sinister things, and that's because we're cynical beings. And we're living in a house, and we're chilling upstairs, and we're doing a podcast. Impaired.